From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The infighting in the Trump White House spilled out onto morning television today. New communications director Anthony Scaramucci calling into CNN, describing the tension between him and President Trump's chief of staff, Reince Priebus.
Some brothers are like Cain and Abel. Other brothers can fight with each other and then get along. I don't know if this is repairable or not. That will be up to the president.
He also tossed out that President Trump might veto the Russia sanctions being considered by Congress. NPR's congressional reporter Jeff Bennett is here. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Robin.
I just want to start with some context. So this started last night when Scaramucci tweeted that his financial disclosures had been leaked. And that was a felony. Well, they hadn't been leaked. They were public. So he deleted the tweet, but he had tagged it to Reince Priebus. Now, reporter Ryan Lizza tweeted, in case there's any ambiguity, Scaramucci does want Priebus investigated for leaks. Lizza also reported that Scaramucci and President Trump had dinner last night with Fox's Sean Hannity. Scaramucci was angry about that leak as well. So here's more of his call to CNN.
There are people inside the administration that think it is their job to save America from this president. Okay, that is not their job.
Jeff, people in the administration want to save America from Trump. Your thoughts?
You know, I'm running out of superlatives to describe just how unconventional the Trump administration is. I found it stunning that Scaramucci, who is the chief messenger of the president, would say that about his colleagues on the record. And, you know, I'm told that Scaramucci spoke to CNN with the blessing of the president. And, by the way, sounding a lot like the president during that, you know, half-hour interview.
Well, he
saying,
said
I'm
it.
Not a politician,
he said
I'm a
it.
Businessman.
He said it. The president has told me to come here and call you. He said it.
Yeah, and he also said that if Reince Priebus wants to explain that he's not the leaker, let him do that.
Yeah.
Really what this is, it's a public fight for influence. Scaramucci already has one victory in that Sean Spicer, the former press secretary, is out. Spicer, we know, objected to Scaramucci's coming into the administration. And who, by the way, is Spicer an ally of? Reince Priebus.
Yeah.
So that's definitely what we're seeing.
Well, but is it also distraction from the troubled health care bill, from the transgender controversy, from the battle with the attorney general? By the way, where are we on that? The attorney general, Jeff Sessions, and Donald Trump's criticism of him.
Well, we do know that Jeff Sessions is in El Salvador today. He's trying to address the street violence, the street gang violence there. But back here in Washington, on the Hill anyway, Republicans are really rising to his defense. Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, said that if Jeff Sessions is fired, there will be holy hell to pay. Mm. And he also said that he's going to introduce bipartisan legislation next week that would require judicial review if the president tries to fire Mueller. I'm interested to see how many Republicans he gets to support that. And then beyond that, Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said he won't hold any hearings for a replacement AG if the president decides to fire Jeff Sessions, or if Sessions, for that matter, resigns. But, you know, to the larger point, we have a president who said he would only hire the best. And here we have Jeff Sessions twisting in the wind, the chief of staff unsure of his future. And there's even some talk that the Secretary of State might not be as plugged in as he should be. So, there's a lot here for the president.
Well, just touch in the minute we have on another potential fight over the Russia sanctions. Scaramucci just tossed out this morning that maybe the president might veto these sanctions. A bill passed by the House yesterday, now in the Senate. It includes limits on the president's ability to undo it. Now, to be fair, Scaramucci said this morning, who knows, maybe President Trump will come up with something tougher on Russia. But your thoughts there?
Well, first of all, there's a strong likelihood that lawmakers will have the votes to override a veto. But, I mean, I think it's also here, again, remarkable that Congress has really given itself an unprecedented oversight role for sort of the Russia part of the sanctions bill, because, as you say, they are really concerned that President Trump has a too warm of a relationship with Vladimir Putin, and they really fear that he could scale back sanctions against Moscow.
Yeah. Well, we also have Senator John Cornyn, the Senate whip, today predicting the Senate would vote to repeal at least the mandate in Obamacare that requires people to buy insurance. So that battle is shaping up perhaps for this afternoon. NPR's congressional reporter, Jeff Bennett, who has a lot to do today. Jeff, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, the nation's top military officer says U.S. policy on transgender people serving in the military will not change until the defense secretary gets policy direction from the president and determines how to implement it. That responds to President Trump's surprise tweets yesterday saying he would ban transgender people from serving. Some transgender service members and veterans are speaking out. Retired U.S. Army Sergeant Shane Ortega, a transgender man in Los Angeles, spoke with MSNBC yesterday about what he thought when he first saw the president's tweets.
My immediate reaction was, this is a completely egotistical move on the behalf of Donald Trump. I think that he's trying to circle in the American public to deflect and detract from the principles and goodwill of what it is to be an American service member. And he's trying to use them as pawns right now in order to invoke some sort of emotional reaction from the public to circumvent his own investigations that are going right now towards his impeachment.
Joining us now is Dominic Holden, who's civil rights and Department of Justice reporter at BuzzFeed News. Dominic, what kind of reaction are you hearing?
One of the things I did yesterday was talk to people who are transgender, some who are serving actively in the military, other family members. You know, they were blindsided by this news. There's one person I spoke to who had not had a chance to talk to their chain of command. They didn't know what it meant for their career. They said it was heartbreaking. You know, one of the things that's been so frustrating for people about this is that it was announced in a series of three tweets from Donald Trump. But what do they mean? You know, yesterday we had Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary, essentially say that there is no policy at this point. They don't know what's going to happen to transgender people. There were questions whether they would be basically sent home from their posts. So there's questions, do they have to change their grooming standards? And Sanders also said that there's, at this point, no timeline to let the Department of Defense know what the White House wants. So there are a lot of outstanding questions and uncertainty about what this means for hundreds or thousands of people who are right now among our troops. And there are concerns that this will actually have the opposite of the supposed effect that Trump wanted, that this would be disruptive to troop readiness rather than facilitating it.
Well, and this comes after President Trump, of course, on the campaign trail, portrayed himself as a real friend of the LGBT community. Here he is speaking last July at the Republican National Convention after the Orlando Pulse nightclub shooting.
As your president, I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens from the violence and oppression of a hateful foreign ideology. Believe me.
So after a speech like that and some of the things that he said on the campaign trail, what is this all about? Why do this right now?
Trump has made overtures to LGBTQ people when he was running for office, but he also made these promises to the Christian conservatives that he needed to push him over the threshold to win. He also agreed to sign legislation protecting people with a religious objection to same-sex marriage. And when Trump was in his transition, he had allies at groups like the Heritage Foundation. They were some of the first to applaud Trump's announcement on Twitter yesterday, saying that this was a practical matter of troop readiness and saving money. So Trump is clearly reaching out to that portion of his base.
And the announcement on Twitter came on the exact same day that the Justice Department filed an amicus brief in a case arguing that a federal civil rights law does not cover sexual orientation. Tell us more about what happened at the Justice Department yesterday.
Right. This is a pretty significant case. There's a man, Donald Zarda. He was a skydiving instructor. And in 2010, he'd filed a lawsuit against his private employer saying that he was fired for being gay and that this was a violation of Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And what's interesting about having the Justice Department weigh in now that it is before the full panel of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals is that the Justice Department is not actually a party to this case. Normally, the Department of Justice doesn't weigh in on private sector cases. And moreover, it's clashing with another federal agency that deals with civil rights laws in the workplace, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, that had supported the gay man. And so we see here U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions sort of stepping outside of the traditional role of the Justice Department and arguing against another agency and arguing against gay rights.
Dominic, before you were covering the Justice Department, you were covering LGBT issues at BuzzFeed. How is the gay community, the LGBT community reacting to what's been happening over the last 24 hours?
You know, I think that LGBT people have been yelling and screaming since last year when Trump made these claims about being friendly to LGBT people. They saw the people he was surrounding himself with, like Mike Pence, an evangelical who's been very conservative on these issues. And they were worried about the policy statements he were making. And they were waiting for this shoe to drop. And that both of it happens on one day is a double whammy where they feel like Trump is showing his true colors and his allegiance to the conservative Republican base. And they're starting to feel like they're really under siege.
That's Dominic Holden, who is civil rights and Department of Justice reporter at BuzzFeed News. Dominic, thanks.
Thank you.
Firefighters in several states west of the Mississippi River are battling wildfires. According to the National Interagency Fire Center, there are 42 uncontained large fires burning in places like Nevada, Oklahoma, and Montana. So far, 2017 is the second hottest year on record, after 2016, and recent record-breaking high temperatures in California and the Southwest are increasing the threat of wildfires. Wildfires have been getting hotter and burning longer in recent years, and writer Gary Ferguson looks closely at what's happening in his new book. It's called Land on Fire, and Gary Ferguson joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy. Good to be with you.
And I want to start with climate change, which you bring up in this book a lot. You write that the fire season is 75 days longer than it was in 1972. There are more rain-free days. There are warmer temperatures in the West. How much worse is the fire season? How much worse are wildfires because of climate change?
Well, the most comprehensive study to come out last year, kind of a collaborative effort between Columbia University and the University of Idaho, suggested that when you pull out all the natural climate change factors, things like ocean circulation patterns and whatnot, human-caused climate change is probably responsible for doubling the number of acres burned since 1985. So it's a very, very fast change. And it looks like from all the evidence out there that this is just simply going to be worse before it gets better.
The other thing is that humans are moving into areas that they didn't live in before, which means that when these fires burn, they might threaten homes more often than they used to.
Absolutely. And that's part of the perfect storm going on. There's something that land use planners refer to as the wildland-urban interface, and that's exactly what it sounds like, people moving into the edge of large swaths of vegetation and in pretty fire-prone areas. And remarkably, 1 billion acres are now in the wildland-urban interface. So that's about 40% of the landmass in the United States. And 200 million acres of that, about 70,000 communities, are living in land that has been designated as high risk for wildfire in the coming years.
And fires don't just destroy homes or buildings and forests. They also have a real effect on air quality and water quality. Tell us about that.
Well, they really do, especially these as of late in the last 15, 16 years, we've had 10 full seasons with at least a dozen so-called mega fires in them. And mega fires are loosely defined as being 100,000 acres, which is a very, very large fire. When you get a fire that big, it creates the kind of heat that can sterilize soil, and it also can actually vaporize vegetation in a way that it creates a sort of a silicon-like covering over the forest floor and turns the soil what's known as hydrophobic. So in the face of that, you've got a forest that can't really come back as far as revegetating itself in the same way, and it's very prone to landslides and debris slides and things like that.
Has that always been the case after a fire, that it's hard for the forest to come back?
Not so much. And while there have always been the occasional, you know, big fires, they have gotten much, much more common since roughly 2000. Typically, in the days of thousands of years before Europeans and Anglos arrived in the West, there were what were called stand maintenance fires burning through. And they were fairly low temperature, smaller fires, 6 to 8 foot tall flames. And they would actually be very healthy. They are very healthy for the forest. And so by eliminating those stand maintenance fires, we allowed the fuel load to build up to an incredibly high degree. We've got about 300 million acres in the West now with unnaturally heavy fuel loads. And so now when the fires go through, they hit these accumulated fuel loads, and that's what makes them hot, that along with climate change, and that's what's sterilizing the soil to a degree and creating these hydrophobic soils to a degree that simply wouldn't have happened with this kind of regularity 50 or 100 years ago.
And by the way, that just brings me to a photo that's in your book of a tree, and you can see all the rings, and you can see exactly when the fires have happened over time.
Yes, it's remarkable. You can cut down an old tree, maybe a 350-year-old tree, and actually scientists cut down a number of these trees in a given 100 acres or so of woods. And they can, as you suggest, see these fire scars, as they're called. And from those fire scars, they can tell the size of the fire, the kind of moisture that was available that year, the direction of the fire, and they can piece together the history of fire. The Native Americans out here have long said that trees are the story keepers of the landscape, and really they're proving to be exactly that for fire researchers.
Tell us about the ponderosa pine, which is so important to this whole issue.
Well, the ponderosa pine is a great example of how the landscape has adapted itself so beautifully across many thousands of years to have fire as a presence. Fire is really an ecological force for good in a lot of ways. The ponderosa pine is one example of dozens and dozens that adapted to live in a fire-prone environment. It tends to drop its lower branches as it gets bigger so that when fires come through, there aren't these what are called ladders for the fire to climb up the tree and destroy the tree by burning the crown. It's developed very thick bark, 1.5, 2 inches thick, so that when normal these stand maintenance fires would come through, it wouldn't harm the cambium layer, which is the essential way that nutrients get up into the canopy of the tree. And on it goes. We've got trees that have adapted with so-called serotonous pine cones that only open in the presence of flame to reseed the ground for the next flush of their trees to return to life. And so lots and lots of really intriguing adaptations that certainly suggest that fire has been on the landscape for thousands of years.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Gary Ferguson, whose new book is called Land on Fire. And it seems from your book like one of the big problems is we've been overdoing it in terms of fire suppression, trying to put out too many fires.
Well, indeed, that's true. Back in 1910, that big burn I mentioned where 3 million acres went up in smoke, tremendous amount of timber loss. A fledgling agency called the U.S. Forest Service that was created by Teddy Roosevelt in 1905 was trying to get its feet on the ground, trying to convince Congress there was a reason for it to be in existence at all. And it took it upon itself to become the firefighting agency, and it did a beautiful job. It even came up with a slogan, which in hindsight was ridiculous, that called the 9 a.m. rule, that if any fire broke out, they would be on it and put it out by 9 o'clock the next morning. Of course, that didn't always happen, but it gives you a sense of how excited and eager they were to battle fire. Fire was really thought of as an enemy. We went to war with wildfire. And we put out fires that, in truth, in hindsight, should have been allowed to burn in wilderness areas where structures weren't threatened or human life and safety wasn't compromised. Those fires should have burned because they would have done the same kinds of good work that those stand maintenance fires had done for a long time, cleaning the forest floor, limiting disease, and returning the nutrients to the soil so that new flushes of even more nutritious life could be available for the wildlife of the forest.
So do they still operate in that way? Are they still fighting too many fires?
Well, not necessarily. Back in the 1980s, your listeners may remember in 1988, there was a tremendous collection of fires in Yellowstone. And after that, there was a pretty big reorganization of policy to allow fires to burn in wild areas, again, where there weren't structures or human lives threatened.
But now there are so many more structures everywhere.
Exactly right. So we've got so many more structures. And in truth, we're just not doing a very good job getting on top of these heavy fuel-laden forests with what are called treatments, and that could be either a prescribed burn, where you go in and intentionally burn, or thinning operations to reduce the flammability of the forest. A typical state like the one I'm speaking to you from, Oregon, tries to get about 5,000 or 6,000 or 7,000 acres treated a year. They've got a backlog of 500,000 acres, plus you have to do that every 8 or 10 or 12 years. And there's simply just not the money to get ahead of this problem.
Another thing I want to ask you about that you get into in this book, and it's fascinating, is how exactly the pyroforensic experts figure out how and where a wildfire started. How do you go into something that is charred and figure out how it started?
Well, it's interesting because a fire will burn in a sort of triangular pattern. So what the fire researchers and the forensic pyroforensic experts do first is try to find the point of that triangle, if you will. And they comb the ground down to a matter of a few square feet. And from that investigation, they can find where it actually began. As it burns, it moves ever outward and generally in one direction, you can piece together the ferocity of the fire, the direction it was moving from, the kind of char on one side of the tree versus the other, the way leaves can be sort of frozen by flames in one direction or another, and also by the winds created by the fire. So using all these clues, they've become very, very good at pinpointing the fire ignition cause, and that's one reason we know how many of them are actually started by humans as opposed to lightning strikes.
And I assume that new technology is going to make that even easier.
I think that's true. We've got an increasing capacity for satellite imaging to the point where we can see actually areas through thermal imaging that are so hot and dry, they can actually pinpoint the amount of heat coming off a forest even before a fire starts. And then as soon as one does start, that thermal technology allows us to see pretty much where it started and narrow it down very quickly.
That's Gary Ferguson, whose new book is called Land on Fire. Gary, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle. And it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
Zardes. Jossie Zardes getting the cross in. Taylor knocked down.
That's forward Jordan Morris scoring a tie-breaking goal in the 88th minute of last night's Gold Cup soccer match, clinching a 2-1 victory for the U.S. over Jamaica. Now, this is the sixth time the U.S. has won the biennial CONCACAF. I love saying that, CONCACAF tournament, crowning the champion of North America and maybe signaling a bright future in the World Cup. The U.S. takes on Costa Rica and New Jersey on September 1st in a World Cup qualifier. Let's bring in Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst, host of the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, pretty thrilling last
yes.
night.
Yes, I could use some CONCA decaf, the Confederation of North Central American and Caribbean Association football, which just rolls off the foot, as it were. That is CONCACAF. So what is CONCACAF, you might be asking? Mm-hmm. Think of it like this. If you're a fan of college basketball, it's like your conference tournament. If you win it, it's great. It's great for the team. And of course, the teamwork that goes into winning such a thing can be translated to the next big tournament, which would be the big dance. And that's what the U.S. national team and all the national teams are trying to do, to qualify for the World Cup. I would say the U.S. was probably a favorite to win the tournament, but Mexico is always a great rival in our region. It's basically the North American and Caribbean teams. Mexico is knocked out of the semifinals by Jamaica, and the United States won a great game over Jamaica yesterday.
Well, American midfielder Michael Bradley named the tournament's best player. We mentioned the forward Jordan Morris with that tie-breaking goal. But, you know, this is coming as news to a lot of people be, you know, how good is this team and should we be paying more attention?
I think they're good. Right now, they're ranked. I wouldn't look at the official FIFA rankings, but rankings which take into account a little more advanced statistics say they're about 14th in the world. That seems right to me. Going into the last World Cup, they were in the teens also. If you outperform that, the United States could, well, hey, they have to get into the World Cup, but they can go far. You named a couple of the best players on the team. They also have Jozy Altidore, who scored the first goal on just a free kick, and it was a beautiful bend it like Beckham type kick. And he's one of the few players in the world that could do that. He is a world-class player. Clint Dempsey's a world-class player who's a striker and a sub. He's 34, but he's a great player. So the United States, as we mentioned these guys, they have a bunch of players who are right up there with maybe not the best in the world, but right up there on the international stage level. The question is, and this is what their coach, Bruce Arena, says, if you don't have the best players, you have to be the best team.
Okay,
so the question is, can these good players gel into a good team? So far, we've seen a lot of evidence. The answer is yes.
Well, and can he do this? Because he's the returning coach, actually. He replaced Jurgen Klinsmann, who was fired last year. They had a bad start. And he's coached this team before. So can he do that? Is he the guy who can do it?
They are undefeated since he took over. You know, there are a lot of draws in soccer. He seems to have the golden touch. They really like him. The Klinsmann era was marked by a lot of discord and maybe a lack of direction. So right now, going into qualifying, this is as good, I would say, this is as good as you could hope for, knowing what we know about the quality of play in the United States, knowing what we know about the United States history in world soccer. It was a very entertaining victory, and this is a very promising team.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. So let's start watching. Come on. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
Today, the House Armed Services Committee met to discuss a recent report from the Government Accountability Office. The GAO report highlights a sting operation which revealed lax oversight of the federal program that transfers excess military equipment to civilian law enforcement agencies. That program became the center of a national debate nearly 3 years ago in Ferguson, Missouri, when people protesting the fatal shooting of Michael Brown were met by police equipped with armored trucks, sniper rifles, tear gas bombs, and full-body combat armor, largely acquired through the military gear program. Then President Obama later issued an executive order to limit the program and provide greater oversight, but this GAO report shows otherwise. Eli Hager is a staff writer for the Marshall Project. That's a nonpartisan news outlet covering criminal justice. Eli, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And the GAO is not what most people think of when they think of sting operations. Tell us what the office did.
It's the Government Accountability Office, and they normally keep other federal agencies accountable and monitor for fraud and abuse by auditing those agencies. But this time they did a sting operation in which they created an entire fake law enforcement agency with a fake website and a fake physical address that traced back to an empty lot. And they applied for $1.2 million worth of military gear from the Department of Defense, and within less than a week, they got it. This fake agency got that equipment.
What kind of equipment were they able to get?
So a lot of what they got was not guns and weapons. It was night vision goggles. It was laser sights to put on the top of rifles, things like that. But they also got simulated rifles and simulated pipe bombs, which you can make functional with commercially available products. And so it was a wide range of things. It was over 100 items, I believe.
What prompted this sting?
So essentially, there's been this 1033 gear giveaway program that the Department of Defense has operated for several decades, in which they give their excess military gear to local law enforcement agencies. But under the Obama administration, an executive order was issued calling for some of the most serious weaponry to be banned from going to local police, and then some other equipment to be what they called controlled, which meant subject to greater oversight and also subject to greater training protocols for any of the police agencies that would want to apply for it. And arising out of that call for oversight, Congress last year actually in its Defense Department reauthorization bill called for the GAO to monitor the deer giveaway program and look for any instances of fraud and abuse.
So is this something that is illegal? Does the GAO discover that the Defense Department shouldn't have sent these pieces of gear to this fake police department?
Well, certainly. I mean, the Defense Department should not be sending military-grade gear and weapons to a completely fake agency that doesn't exist and doesn't have a physical address. They didn't even check for ID when the fake law enforcement agency showed up at the Defense Department warehouse to pick it up. So certainly not something that should be happening.
What if it had been a real police department asking for this?
Well, that's the larger question. I mean, if you talk to advocates against the militarization of police, they would say that obviously it's wrong for a fake law enforcement agency to be getting all of this military-grade equipment. But why should real law enforcement agencies be getting some of this stuff anyway? I mean, the program has given away Humvees and armored trucks and grenade launchers and helicopters and even scuba diving gear. And a lot of advocates, especially post-Ferguson, have asked why do any law enforcement agencies need that type of equipment.
Well, has there been reaction from lawmakers or the Defense Department to the GAO report?
Yes, the Defense Department has already said that it will tighten its verification procedures, including by checking in on the physical locations of any police agencies that apply for equipment and also by checking for ID and conducting an internal audit, you know, as to why this kind of thing could have happened.
And when it comes to the program overall, we know that President Trump has promised to undo the Obama executive order anyway.
He has repeatedly promised to undo the Obama executive order, especially in his promises to the National Police Union organizations. But he actually hasn't done so yet. But what does seem to have happened is that the oversight that the Justice Department and the Defense Department had been doing of the program seems to have fallen away a little bit since in the last 6 months of the Trump administration.
That's Eli Hager, who's a staff writer for the Marshall Project. Eli, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, as far as we know, there are no KC-135 stratotankers on the list of excess military equipment handed over to local law enforcement. The stratotankers are those huge planes that refuel other planes in flight, allowing U.S. military aircraft to get anywhere in the world without stopping. The Air Force operates about 400 KC-135s. Nine of them are kept at Scott Air Force Base in southern Illinois, home to the Illinois National Guard's 126th Air Refueling Wing. The unit has flown more than 300 missions since last December, and St. Louis Public Radio's Maria Altman got a chance to take a ride.
The first time I was scheduled to go up with the crew of a KC-135, high winds kept our flight grounded. Hear that? Those are the jet's massive engine fan blades turning in the wind. So instead of a flight, I got a tour of the plane with Colonel Jeff Jacobson.
I'm a vice wing commander at the 126th Air Refueling Wing.
He's been flying the KC-135 since 1986, but this Boeing jet has been around a lot longer than that.
So in 1963, this thing rolled off the assembly line and came into service.
The wing has eight of these stratotankers. It's a workhorse that can carry 33,000 gallons of fuel and offload it in midair to a waiting aircraft. As the 126th's motto says, anytime, anywhere.
We can air refuel almost every aircraft in the Air Force and Navy and the Marines inventory. So we are asked to refuel in a lot of different places, day, night, all around the clock.
To prepare, the wing's 850 guardsmen and 100 active duty members fly 2 to 3 training missions every day. Eventually, I do get on one of those training missions to refuel F-16s over Wisconsin. You're hearing pilots Colonel Tom Jackson, the 126th Operations Commander, and Major Vivica Lane. Lane happens to be one of only 2 women out of the wing's 60 pilots.
I joined the Guard specifically to fly the KC-135. And I love it.
She seems to get a kick out of the mid-air refueling sorties.
If you think about the fact that every time we fly, we have controlled mid-air collisions, it's pretty phenomenal.
So picture 2 airplanes each going upwards of 300 miles per hour, the KC-135 flying about 40 feet above the plane that will get refueled. Then the KC-135 extends a boom up to 16 feet and connects with the receiving aircraft's fuel tank. That last part is done by the boom operator. On this flight, that's Alberto Ayala.
I've been a boom operator for about 2 years now.
He shows me what's called the boom pod in the back of the plane.
So right now the boom is all the way stowed. As you can see, the elevation is all the way up. When we go to air refuel, the boom will come down.
A while later, Ayala goes to work. He lays on his stomach looking out a small window. An F-16 comes into view below, and soon he connects the boom. In just a couple of minutes, thousands of pounds of fuel are offloaded to the F-16. Back on the ground, Ayala makes it sound like it was no big deal.
The air refueling went pretty smooth overall. There was a little bit of turbulence, but it wasn't too bad.
And 126 Operations Commander Colonel Tom Jackson confirms it all went as planned.
Today's training mission simulated exactly what we do in combat. Take off, join up with some fighters in an airspace over a certain area at a specific time, give them the gas they needed so they go back into the fight, and then we can recover back to a recovery base and then regenerate for our next mission.
As we get ready to leave, I ask if anyone wants to add anything. Major Vivica Lane says she has a message for listeners.
Yeah, just that folks back home maybe forget that we're out there and what we're doing. It's not always at the forefront. Maybe because the global war on terror has kind of gone on for so long, I think people tend to forget about it if they don't have an immediate family member involved. And just for Americans to remember that we're out there fighting for them.
Right now, the 126 has two KC-135s deployed with crew in Turkey and in the Middle East involved in missions over Iraq and Syria. They'll be there through the summer. For Here and Now, I'm Maria Altman.
Amazon is reportedly getting into the world of messaging. Tech bloggers say that Amazon's Anytime will work on computers and mobile devices, allowing text, video, and photo messaging and games. But aren't there enough messaging apps already? Joanna Stern is the Wall Street Journal's personal technology columnist, and she joins us to talk messaging apps. Joanna, there are a lot, aren't there?
Yeah. I mean, when a company announces a new messaging app, my first reaction is always, because we need another one of these, right? It's like, we need another potato chip flavor or I mean, actually, I guess we don't mind those, right? But
right.
How many of these can we possibly have to choose from?
Well, look, some of us are just still texting with text on our smartphones. So what are the top apps right now?
Yeah, well, actually, it's funny that you mentioned that you're just texting with text because you're not. So if you've got an iPhone, you're using iMessage, which is Apple's version of a messaging app, mm-hmm. right? And last year, Apple loaded that up with all different types of fun things like new emojis and stickers and apps. And soon they're going to add the ability to send money to a friend through iMessage. So all the big tech giants now have messaging apps and they want everyone to be on their platform because a messaging app is only as good as the people that are there. And so Apple's got iMessage, Facebook has Facebook Messenger, they also own WhatsApp, they also own Instagram, there's Snapchat, there's Google Hangouts, there's Google Allo. So the landscape is very crowded, but the important thing to remember is that no matter how many features or services they add, it ultimately comes down to where are the people you know.
It's all about the people you know, and the companies only care about that. Here comes a stupid question. Are they collecting some information out of this?
It's not a stupid question. And the main reason messaging apps are important to these companies is they want you to be in their products, right? The fight right now in Silicon Valley amongst these big companies is we want you to be our users, right? So Facebook wants you in Facebook Messenger so you spend more time on Facebook or on WhatsApp and Instagram. They're getting this family of services to work together so you're in Facebook's world wherever you are. Same with Apple, right? Apple wants you to be in iMessage because then you'll buy more iPhones or you'll buy whatever the next big thing Apple makes, right? Because that service just works on Apple's products. It's the same for Google. Google wants you to be more in its services, so you'll use Google Search. So messaging can really be looked at as sort of a little link between all of the other things. They might not make money directly on messaging, right? Mm-hmm. You don't probably pay for that app. You might not even see ads in your messaging app, but you are using other services, and that's where they make the money.
You know, I thought it was a stupid question because I'm just assuming that everything I do now, the only reason this service is being offered is not because some techno giant thinks that it's...
Yeah, they don't care about you.
Yeah, they don't care about me. But they are collecting data. Is there some way that they're using data here?
So that's a very good question. And so when you are thinking about what messaging app you use, you do want to know about the word encryption, right? Is the message you're sending secure? Is it landing on the company's servers? Can somebody intercept it? Now, many of these messaging apps offer encryption. Some of them don't do it by default. So iMessage, which is on your iPhone, that is encrypted by default. Facebook Messenger, you have to turn on the setting. In many of Google's chat apps, you've got to turn on that setting. So that's something you want to be cognizant of. Now, when you talk about other services they can build into the apps to get your information, that's something that's starting to happen. And so you might have heard this term chat bots, right? Mm-hmm. It is a service that might offer you information. So if it sees that you are sending something about, let's go see this movie, it might serve up something that says, oh, do you want to send more information about this movie? Would you like to search about that movie? This is something Google has built into some of its chat apps and Facebook is also working on. And so there it is looking at what you're saying because it needs to search for that information based on your text.
And by the way, some other encrypted chats are Signal, Confide, Telegram. We've heard from a colleague who uses a more open chat system, messaging system for a group of people and then a closed one maybe for, you know, one person that he's talking with. Is there benefit to having, you know, more than one app?
So I think you can't avoid now having more than one app. You basically have conversations going on in all of these places, right? You might have someone on Facebook Messenger who you're Facebook friends with, but they might not know your phone number, so they're not going to iMessage you. They might not know your email, so they might not be on Gmail. So I think it's pretty impossible at this point to just have one place for chatting. I wish we could have it. I think that's the dream. My guess is that if Amazon or any of these other companies enter with a new service, they're all going to try and promise, this is the one place you can chat.
Well, you know, I was thinking as you were speaking, well, this just isn't true. I really think I just use one message app. You know, I text, but then I remembered that, of course, I use direct message on Twitter and I use WhatsApp for people overseas, particularly one friend, because that's all she uses. So if your world expands, you...
And I get, are you a Facebook user?
No, stop. Never. Not going there. No.
You've never used Facebook?
No.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, then I should do a story about you.
Yes, I'm the one. That's Joanna Stern, the Wall Street Journal's personal technology columnist. Joanna, thank you so much.
Sure.
Jeremy, you know me. One more thing to do.
Well, I say the less social media, the better. But there are still a few billion people just like you in the world, Robin, that aren't using Facebook.
Really?
Still a few billion left.
Let us hear from you. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.